Hello, tech lovers, and welcome to the Gadget Show podcast. I am Susie Perry.
I'm Jason Bradbury, with a big shout out to CEX for sponsoring this week's episode.
Yeah, if you're eyeing up a tech upgrade, but you don't fancy paying brand new prices, then CEX has got you covered.
Yeah, trade in phones, tablets, games, or cameras that you're not using anymore.
And turn them into cash or credit towards refurbished tech.
We're talking the latest phones, consoles, games, and cameras for a lot less than new.
Everything is fully tested.
And backed by a 5-year warranty, so you can upgrade with confidence.
Head to webuy.com or into a CEX store and see what your tech is worth. On the way this week, all the details of the first iPhone for 2026, fighting robots, Jony Ive and Ferrari's partnership, and the latest on more VR from Meta. But before we get into that, Jace, anything that you come across this week that's got you excited, that's piqued your interest?
Always, I can't help myself. Something I've seen this week that I think is really interesting, but it needs a tiny bit of explaining first. So most electric cars today, as you probably know, use lithium-ion batteries or lithium-ion phosphate, right?
Yeah.
Which are great for range and charging speed, so we don't have to wait forever when we're charging at the service station. But they have downsides. Lithium is relatively scarce, okay? It's a very expensive material to mine, and those batteries don't like extreme cold, and you'll know that if you're an electric car owner because your range drops significantly in the UK during winter times. A sodium ion battery does the same basic job, but it uses sodium instead of lithium, obviously, hence the name. And sodium is a massively more abundant material found all over the world and is potentially cheaper and also safer to produce. The trade-off, lower energy density, so you normally get less range from a sodium lithium battery. Now, here's the bit that grabbed my attention this week. The world's first mass-produced sodium ion battery for cars has officially entered production, and it's going into a real electric car you can actually buy in China. I call it China. Some people say China.
Yeah,
well, no. Boring, isn't it? No, China. It's called the Chang'an Nevo A06. Nattily named. The batteries have been developed by CATL, who are one of the biggest EV battery manufacturers on the planet. Again, probably mispronounced that too. So this isn't some startup experiment. It's, you know, a proper established industrial outfit out of China. They've just finished winter testing in Inner Mongolia. Not Outer Mongolia, all right? Inner Mongolia.
That's the only one you ever hear of, though, Outer Mongolia.
The other one's a bit cold, isn't it? Where temperatures drop to levels that most EVs would absolutely hate. And the results are kind of wild. The car was able to charge at around minus 30 degrees Celsius. And it kept operating at temperatures as low as minus 50. Even at minus 40, the battery reportedly retained more than 90% of its original capacity. Well, that's absolutely extraordinary. To give you a sense, Suze, my first electric car was a Renault something. And its range was, in the summer, 220 miles, right? That's first generation, you know, a few years ago.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awful, but it was doable. And I could get from here in Newquay to Exeter in Devon, I think, and back easily, right? No problems. And that's where I get the train to go to London and stuff, right? In the winter, it dropped to 180 miles, which meant that literally, I could just about get to Exeter, and then when I came back from my trip, it was like I was on, well, it wouldn't be fumes, would it? It'd be on volts, but it was like a touch and go whether I'd make it home. That's how critical it is for people living in the UK, let alone somewhere as cold as Inner Mongolia. So EVs are finally getting, you know, a real choice, different chemistries for different jobs, and that's huge news for a space that needs innovation constantly. And in the long term, if sodium ion scales, it's very likely this won't stop with cars. Cheaper, safer batteries that cope better with cold could absolutely trickle down into consumer tech. Mm. You know, things like energy storage and, you know, maybe even phones. Either way, it feels like a genuinely important moment for how batteries and electric vehicles evolve from here. And that's what got me excited this
year. Yeah, because the bigger picture as well, isn't it? You mentioned it in there. You know, if somebody's got the monopoly, if one country's got the monopoly on a certain element, or, you know, we can see that it's It's massive.
Geopolitically, it's massive.
Yeah. So, to have a more open market for anything like that has got to be a good thing.
Well, what's tickled your fancy this week?
On a consumer sort of, techie level, I spotted that it finally looks like Apple might actually be about to do something meaningful with Siri.
Okay.
Any buns?
About time, guys.
It's been a long time.
Hello?
You could argue that Siri probably needed an overhaul before AI became the buzzword of the decade, couldn't you really? They've kept us waiting for, what is it now, about 18 months, it's over 18 months, since first announcing this big AI power upgrade. Anyway,
Apple Intelligence, yeah.
Yeah.
iPhone 16 Pro, I think it was.
I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, because if you owned a 15, apparently, if you had the 15 Pro, it was backwardly compatible, but that was the only model below the 16. I might have got this wrong. I'm just vibing.
That's right, Jace. I'm sure it is. Anyway, according to some rather reliable sources at Apple, Apple is expected to release the first developer beta of iOS 26.4 in the week beginning February the 23rd. So we're only days away, really. And this is the update where Siri is finally meant to actually be a bit smarter. So the big headline, really, is that Siri should be able to understand your personal context. So things like pulling information from your emails, notes and messages. Plus, it'll have on-screen awareness and be able to take actions within and across apps, which is frankly what we've all sort of assumed that Siri could already do, but it can't really. So things like if you said, find that email I mentioned earlier, or send the photo to the person I was just talking to, it might actually work. I'm just saying might.
It might actually work. Might.
Well, yeah, without you throwing your phone across the room. There is a catch. The first version, I'm sorry, but the first version won't include the full chatbot style Siri makeover.
Obviously.
It's apparently not landing till iOS 27, which will be later on this year. So it's a bit more of a foundation update, if you like, rather than a full AI glow up. Bottom line, though, it kind of feels like Apple is finally starting to deliver on the Siri promises that it's been making for a very long time. We just have to now wait and see if it's actually good or slightly less useless than it currently is. What do you think?
Well, obviously, what is it that, who are they teaming up with for this? Where are they getting the grunt from?
Yeah, so Gemini, because they were teamed up with Google, haven't they? So they'll be using Gemini, so that's pretty solid.
Yeah. I just, I'm still reeling from the appalling reality that they sold the iPhone 16 Pro based on Apple Intelligence and then the 17 Pro. And to my knowledge, and again, I'm just vibing now, but all I've experienced by way of Apple Intelligence on my 16 Pro is contextual summaries of things like emails and things like that, which is quite useful. I get to look at the screen and get a quick sense of whether that's an important email or one that I don't necessarily need to open just yet because I'm busy or whatever. And then all the kind of emoji type stuff, which I'm not seven, so I don't care about making a cute character.
So it's still hurting from
well,
that.
No, it is when a brand that's as cash rich and formerly as innovative as Apple don't deliver, it's a big deal. It's just if it was a new phone brand that had a limited investment, so that their innovation would be held back by a lack of funding or market penetration, do you know what I mean? Then you kind of give them a little bit of a space. But it's Apple. What the hell? And weren't they in bed with OpenAI? I mean, that was the sell back then. It's just, I think if you know what's gone on, then that's why you react like me. If you're not into this, then maybe you've missed the fact that they promised all this 18 months ago.
I think it's fair to say that the entire situation has been a cock-up.
Right, if you haven't heard yet, where have you been? The Gadget Show competition is back, and this one is big.
Very big. We're talking a whopping £5,000 to spend at CEX, all on whatever tech you want.
That's £5,000 to blow on gadgets, old or new. So let's do a roll call of what you could actually get.
You could walk away with a top-end iPhone or flagship Android smartphone.
A PlayStation 5, an Xbox, a Switch 2, a powerful gaming PC or a sleek laptop.
The latest iPad, a top-spec DSLR camera, lenses and filming kit.
You could even kick off a retro gaming collection with some classic consoles and loads of games.
A smartwatch, some headphones or earbuds and speakers.
A VR headset, streaming gear, controllers and accessories.
Basically, whatever tech you've been dreaming about, you could buy it.
All you've got to do is head over to patreon.com/thegadgetshow and join one of our paid tiers, which start from as little as the price of a cup of coffee. We've got three tiers, light, mid and max, and depending on which tier you're on, you'll get more entries into the competition.
So the light tier gets you one entry, the mid tier gets you three entries, and the max tier gets you five entries, giving you obviously the best chance of winning.
Once you've chosen your tier, you'll need to direct message the answer to this multiple choice question. In what year did The Gadget Show first air on TV? Was it A, 2002, B, 2004, C, 2006, or D, 2007? And remember, being a paid member doesn't just get you into the competition.
Yeah, you'll also unlock ad-free listening, early access to episodes, and exclusive bonus episodes. And for the first time, we're offering the complete archive of Gadget Show episodes. Yes, that's over 20 years and nearly 500 episodes of gadgety goodness just for our max subscribers.
Epic. So if you fancy supporting the podcast, getting loads of extra content and having a chance to win £5,000 to spend at CEX, head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow and get subscribed.
For full terms and conditions, please visit the link via this episode. It does look like that we're getting the first new iPhone of 2026. There could be a bit of good news and a bit of bad news for Apple's next mid-range phone. So the good news is it sounds like it's going to land really soon, and there probably won't be a price rise. So that's good. The bad news is there might not be very much to get excited about, which is a little bit backing up what you've just said. Yeah, the iPhone 17e is expected to arrive imminently, which could mean within days. Who knows, by the time you listen to this podcast, it could already be out. So currently, February the 19th has been mentioned as a possible launch date with a reassuring price point, likely to start at $599 in the US. And if Apple keeps things consistent elsewhere, that would mean the same in pounds in the UK. But in terms of upgrades, expectations should probably be kept a little bit in check. The leak suggests the main changes are an A19 chip, up from the A18, and the addition of MagSafe support. And that might be about it. If all of that turns out to be true, the iPhone 17e could still end up being a solid mid-range option, even if it sounds a little bit underwhelming as I'm saying this. And that's partly because one of its main rivals, the Pixel 10a, is also expected to be a fairly modest upgrade when it arrives. So if the alternatives either cost more or offer even less, Apple could actually find themselves in quite a strong position with the 17e, even if it's not exactly the phone that's getting anybody excited. I just find all this quite interesting, really.
But again, they're leading with a new phone launch using a story about an AI service that still hasn't transpired.
We'll see. And we'll see the reflection on the feelings of the market in the sales, won't we?
Yeah, but that's only one metric, isn't it? And it doesn't change the fact that they're... my relationship with the brand has been damaged because what they said they were going to do, they didn't do. They've let little things out, you know, like email summaries and cute emojis, but that's not intelligence. It's woefully inadequate. Anyway, I want to give you something that's going to sound, Suze, like something straight out of a science fiction film. It sounds like we're doing that all the time, isn't it, on this show, because we're living in such amazing times. But China have just launched what it's called the world's first Free Humanoid Robot Combat League. Now, you'll know I'm something of an advocate of robot fighting. I created my own YouTube channel, albeit not very successfully, trying to preempt something like this with little bipedal robots fighting each other. And we played with them on The Gadget Show and did some cool stuff in Japan and that. But this looks like it could well be the real deal, an actual humanoid robot combat league. It's called the Ultimate Robot Knockout Legend, or UKRL, and it's kicked off in Shenzhen this week. And here's the wild part. The robots are being provided free of charge to competing teams. Mm. They're all using the same humanoid machine, and it's called the Engine AI T-800.
T-800!
Mm. Reminds you of some film. And the winning team walks away with a gold championship belt worth the equivalent of about $1.4 million. It's not small fry.
I didn't think you were going to say that.
Yeah. And well, the T-800 looks, you know, to all intents and purposes, not to be a gimmick. Engine AI unveiled it late last year, and with videos of it performing genuinely impressive martial art moves, it got quite a few people excited. The sidekicks spinning, capoeira-style attacks, even a full 360-degree aerial move. And this isn't just choreography. I mean, again, it's coming from China. I haven't been there. I haven't played with it myself. So, you know, take it as read. It's built with aviation-grade aluminium, has active cooling in its joint legs, because obviously the servos, the actuators are going to get super hot with all that super fast movement. Mm. And it runs on solid-state lithium batteries that can apparently sustain heavy intensity movement for up to 4 hours.
It's might also get some sodium batteries.
Don't they? Just, yeah.
Yeah.
For fighting in the snow. It's also loaded with sensors, a 360-degree LiDAR, stereo cameras, and all of this is designed to keep it aware of its surroundings and balanced in real time. That's probably good based on the fact that it can do a flying kick. You know, you'd hope that it's aware of its surroundings. But there's a bigger play here. Chinese analysts are saying events like this are designed to accelerate real-world development of actual robots, all right? Combat testing pushes things like, you know, motion control, dynamic balance, that environmental awareness that I just mentioned, impact resistance, et cetera, to the limits. You know, it's basically stress testing, you know, hardware, isn't it, under yeah. extreme conditions, in a way that means that they can take all that data for some eventual reality where they are working among us. You know, there's also a strategic element. By giving the robots away to teams, smaller companies and research groups can, you know, move them on. They can do their whole, they're kind of doing the R&D for the robot company, aren't they?
Yeah, whilst having fun.
What starts as a robot fight could ultimately influence robots working in warehouses, hospitals, or even, Susie, your front room. But it's also a very serious signal about where humanoid robotics is heading. Look, I'm here for it. I'm ever so slightly terrified by
yeah,
it. But
I'm really terrified of it.
But, you know, it's happening. And remember, you heard it here first on the Gadget Show podcast.
Anyway, moving on. You know, Johnny Ive, obviously of Apple fame, it sounds like he's been busy beyond the AI, the OpenAI partnership that we've discussed. It looks like he's trying to scratch an itch of that car that he was never able to design.
Oh, yeah.
With Apple. Remember, I used to go on about the car all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's teamed up with longtime collaborator Mark Newson to design the cockpit of Ferrari's upcoming electric car. And in the process, he's taken a fairly clear swipe at Tesla interiors. Now, this is where I think it's really interesting. So the car is called what I think is the Luce. It's L-U-C-E, and I'm guessing it's got an Italian, you know, theme to it. It'll be Ferrari's first fully electric vehicle. Now, if you've ever sat in a Tesla, you'll know the vibe. It's got one massive touchscreen, few physical buttons, everything is buried in menus, and that is very much not the direction that I've wanted to go in. So speaking to The Drive and Autocar, I've said he doesn't believe large touchscreens work well in cars, practically or functionally. In his words, they force you to look at them, which you shouldn't be doing when you're driving, for obvious reasons, and they create interfaces that are layers and layers deep. And then came the line that really felt like it was aimed at Tesla. I've said the idea that just because a car is electric, the interface should be fully digital is nonsense. Which might sound surprising given the man behind the iPhone and the iPad, but his argument is that touchscreens served a purpose on those devices, whereas the inside of the car is a completely different and far more demanding environment. So instead, for the Ferrari Luce, Ive and Newsom wanted to explore something more physical and more engaging, combining the best parts of analog displays with digital runs rather than replacing everything with a screen. So Ferrari's first fully electric car has been a long time coming. It was originally expected actually last year. We don't know everything yet, but between Ferrari's first EV and Jony Ive redesigning what a car interior should feel like, this is shaping up to be one of the most interesting electric cars, I think, on the horizon. And yes, we will absolutely keep you posted as we get closer to the full reveal. What do you reckon?
I guess the Ferrari is a bit different, isn't it? Because it's a real driver's car. Mm. Even an electric Ferrari is, you know, the kind of person that can afford a brand new electric Ferrari is not your average driver. And so I get that Ive wants to give them more of a traditional driver's experience, even though it's a state-of-the-art electric car. Makes sense to me. But I almost feel like the Tesla and the electric Ferrari, well, there's no feeling. They are very different machines for very different jobs. You know what I mean? So, Susie, you probably know this, but I'm a little bit worried about VR, you know, because Meta, who are really important in virtual reality because they've pushed the market to the masses for so many years, they're in a slightly strange place right now. You know, they've had massive layoffs of many of the major design game design studios, which does make those of us in the VR community start to question their commitment. You know, and they're coming off several years of hardware dominance. The Quest headsets have pretty much been the most accessible, mass appealing way into VR.
Unquestionable.
But, yeah, absolutely. So its most recent headset, the Quest 3S, did relatively well at the beginning, but in recent months has not done that well. But Meta say that they're still, you know, full steam ahead, all right? You know, despite this concern around closing down so many development studios. However, there's some interesting news on the horizon with regard to some recent leaks that are suggesting that we're going to see more Quest devices, but they're going to be dramatically smaller than anything that Meta have offered before. One of the headsets is reportedly codenamed Phoenix, and this week a couple of well-known leakers, we love this, don't we, Suze, when we get to see...
Love well-known leakers.
Yeah, like my nan, well-known in Stourbridge. A couple of well-known leakers shared mock-ups of what it might look like. One says it's a bit similar to the Quest 3. The other shows a separate battery pack. That's interesting, isn't it? A bit like the Vision Pro, which is a big clue as to how Meta plans to shrink down these devices. If the mock-ups are accurate, Phoenix looks like a genuine halfway point between a traditional VR helmet and, Susie, AR smart glasses. We're back there.
Oh, no.
Much lighter, far more wearable, and likely to be a bit more comfortable for, you know, for long sessions. As for when we might hear anything official, Meta typically saves hardware announcements for Meta Connect. And the next one, I'm afraid, isn't due until October. So that means quite a long wait, even if these leaks are genuine. There are also rumours that Phoenix wouldn't replace the usual Quest lineup, but launch alongside a more conventional headset. Personally, I'm fascinated, but I'm not entirely sold. You know, the battery on the hip thing doesn't do it for me.
No, it just feels a bit 80s, actually.
It does a bit. You know, I'm kind of
but
mentally...
But it's taking the weight off, I suppose, isn't it? Which is something that, you know, people do complain about. But, like, you're just moving it somewhere else. I don't know.
I know it doesn't work like this, but I'm just mentally in the augmented reality glasses. I'm already there. I'm like these with a bit of gaming and movie option for when I'm on a plane. I just want to get there. And I suppose if I have to have some battery pack on my hip, yeah, as an interim before they actually get to the future I've been waiting for. Anyway, interesting stuff. Phoenix, codename Phoenix, news at least that, you know, is a bit more hopeful about, you know, Meta's dedication to keeping us going, keeping that VR innovation going.
Will Phoenix rise from the ashes?
Oh, I love it. Right, that's a wrap on this week's episode of the Gadget Show podcast.
It is, but before we disappear, it's time to send some serious love to our brilliant Patreon supporters, the hardcore Gadget gang who keep this show alive and ticking.
Yes, massive thanks and big shout outs go to Fluky D, Paul Sharrock, Phil Eastwood, Colin Taylor, Alan Williams, Chris Hughes, Martin Budnarowski, I'm getting used to that now, Peter Pinner, Timmy Bigger, Dave Green, Ren Mandagorn, and Mark. You are all absolute legends, the lot of you.
And a huge thank you to Dean Day, Chris Cool, Stephen Green, Colin Jones, Gordon Packer, Richard Martin, Simon Ryland, Philip Eddington, Richard Wykes, and Danny Rushton.
And finally, rounding things out in style, a massive thank you to Tall Man with Glasses, Skewy Cat, Dave McHugh, Matthew Riley, Darren McCracken, Andrew Bamford, and Duncan Bell.
And if you'd like to join this illustrious list, where you'll be in with a chance of winning the incredible £5,000 CEX prize fund, unlock bonus episodes, extras, and enjoy, of course, that lovely ad-free feed,
just head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow, sign up and join some very fine company.
And we'll see you soon for the Inbox Edition. Goodbye.
See you then. Bye.
The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Susie was presented by Jason Bradbury and Susie Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.